Here's Uncle Don yet again with the 287th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM at UNBC in Prince George. Rebroadcasts on CHLS in Lillooet and CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake. As a longtime pessimist who's been predicting this financial meltdown for years, I'm gratified. I have no dog in this fight as I'm not in the stock market. Although I feel for the little folk who are losing their homes and jobs, I view the comeuppance of those masters of the universe with glowing heart. Oh, I can't use that term, with glowing heart, can I? As it has been trademarked by the Vancouver Olympic Organizing Committee. This joins a whole raft of words and expressions that are no-nos, at least until 2011. I'm thinking of applying for a trademark on the phrase, "Stand on guard for thee." Just think of the royalties I could collect every time our anthem is sung at the hockey game. If that works, I can go for the gold and copyright "That Bloody Idiot" and garner a fee every time there's a conversation about politicians. The world would be my oyster and I could be rich, at least in falling Canadian dollars. Those listening to me live may not have voted yet. If you haven't, get off your butt and do so, unless you haven't made up your mind. Voting decisions are best not made in the voting booth or in tune with the latest advertisement you saw on television. If you're undecided, give us a break and stay home. The newly anointed Prime Minister of Canada will be meeting in a couple of days with European leaders to discuss economic integration on the NAFTA model. Whether this is a good idea or not, I doubt that has much chance of coming off. Pierre Trudeau had a vision of opening Canada to Europe and Asia while lessening our dependence on the United States for trade. He took the first tentative step by pushing introduction of metric measurements so Canada would join the vast majority of the world's nations. Unfortunately for Canada, he turned the task over to a metrification commission, which pussyfooted around the task and never completed it. Their plan was to bring in Celsius for temperatures and then proceed gradually to the gram and meter system for weight and length, area and volume. Their major area was adopting soft rather than hard conversion. At about the same time as Canada was going metric, Australia was doing the same. Their people had earlier been prepared for this as they converted their money from pounds, shillings, and pence to a metric dollar. Their hard conversion forced manufacturers and importers to move into standard metric sizes. Instead of following the Canadian pattern of just adding metric measurements to imperial packaging, they went all the way. While Canada saw the addition of the measurement 454 grams to a pound of coffee, the Aussies forced the introduction of packages in rounded figures. No more pounds for Australia. Instead, Aussies bought coffee in kilogram and half kilogram sizes. We started going to metric lengths with floor coverings, which had to be sold by the square meter. Since the demise of the Metrification Commission, legal standards are no longer enforced, and square feet is the common sales unit. Likewise for volume. For a while, 8 and 12 ounce cups were replaced by 150 and 250 milliliter sizes. Non-enforcement of the laws has seen the old American measurements return. Produce was to be weighed in kilograms, but the commission allowed parallel pricing in pounds. Therefore, you see markets with the imperial weight in large numbers and the metric in small. We even have an old town farmer's market in Prince George that defies the law by omitting a metric altogether. Europeans are not about to adopt American measurements common in Canada, and we will not go through the whole process of conversion again. It's a pity, but by our slackness in enforcing our own laws, we're missing a chance to diversify from dependence on the dying American empire. Canadian bureaucrats' approach to metric conversion brings to mind the old admonition, "Never plan a vast project in a half-vast way," and I pronounce that carefully. From all the fuss over the American government's nationalization of failing financial institutions, you'd think that government takeovers have never happened before. Not so. My father told me of a case that isn't common knowledge. He graduated as an engineer just before the Second World War. After Pearl Harbor attack, he joined the Navy. It was given short basic training and commissioned as an officer. He hadn't been in uniform long before he was sent to Bloomfield, New Jersey, where a General Electric plant held a number of military contracts. Management was a mess, and they were not meeting commitments, causing cascading problems along the line of supply. Among the contracts falling behind was one for components of the mysterious Manhattan Project. the U.S. Navy effectively sidelined General Electric management, taking over all of its functions. This was fine with GE, I suppose, as the Navy did the work and GE got the profits. My father was involved in allocating manpower and resources to contracts according to priorities. For instance, top priority went to any preparations for the D-Day invasion of Europe. It was trumped only if the requisition read Manhattan Project. My father continued to participate in the running of that General Electric plant through that day in August 1945 when President Truman announced that an atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. "That's the Manhattan Project," my father said. So the war ended, military contracts ran out, and the factory was quietly returned to the care of the civilian incompetents who'd been sitting on the sidelines. This nationalization and the incompetence of General Electric's leaders was forgotten. They took the money and ran, thank you very much. Nationalizations come in many varieties, some acknowledged and some not. Now that a massive $850 billion bill has been passed that will supposedly save the American financial system, congressmen are rushing to rationalize their voting for this massive giveaway. They're all up for re-election next month and must placate their constituents. Outrage that led them to reject the initial $700 billion version was cast aside when the legislation was fattened with $150 billion in pork, those tax breaks and subsidies aimed at wavering congressmen's pet interests. One representative was bought off by having an excise tax on arrow shafts rescinded. For this, he voted for a bill that will cost an average American $2,500. We're bombarded with propaganda explaining that a public cleanup of the mess left by unregulated greed of Wall Street was necessary to prevent an unmitigated financial disaster. You may have noticed a slight change in their pitch. What was once termed a bailout is now being called a rescue. This change was crafted carefully to build a more favorable image. The word rescue brings forth a picture of heroes saving maidens from dragons, whereas bailout conjures up buckets. Manipulation of language is not unique to this crisis. Look at how the war against Afghanistan was relabeled a mission. The messy tar sands have morphed into the friendly oil sands. To borrow from the Yankee election campaign, you can put lipstick on a pig, but you still have a pig. Put a euphemism on a disaster, and you still have a disaster. Who remembers those ancient days, maybe a year ago, when hotshot red suspender Wall Street MBAs chanted the mantra that government just needed to leave markets alone and we would all be rich? There was a popular book in those days entitled Dow 35,000, predicting that this stock average, now collapsed to below 10,000, would hit that level soon. The tune has changed. Those traders raking in millions a year were quick to quote Adam Smith, the author of Wealth of Nations, published in that fateful year 1776. One they loved was, "It is the highest impertinence and presumption in kings and ministers to pretend to watch over the economy of private people and to restrain their expense. They are themselves always, and without any exception, the greatest spendthrifts in society. Let them look well after their own expense, and they may safely trust private people with theirs." That was then. This is now. Here's the current quote from Bill Gross, the manager of the world's largest bond fund, referring to current government bailouts and support for private finance. Quote, "The benevolent fist of government will now join hands with Adam Smith in a most visible manner." End quote. So the heavy hand of government has suddenly morphed into a benevolent fist. I guess it depends on whose ox is being gored as to what one thinks of government intervention and for whose benefit it is exercised. If the hundreds of billions in U.S. government money had gone into bailing out stranded mortgage holders, Gross's tune might have been different. I learned a new expression the other day. It is fecal alcohol syndrome, not to be confused with fetal alcohol syndrome. The latter affects the developing human embryo in the female womb, whereas fecal alcohol syndrome is most commonly exhibited in chronologically mature males who drink too much and then talk crap. Use this new phrase in a sentence every day. Prime Minister Harper, although a professed Christian, seems not to have taken lessons from his Bible to heart. It is up to me, an atheist, to instruct him where his religious upbringing has failed. I refer to Genesis 41, wherein Egypt's Pharaoh had the dream of 7 fat cows followed by 7 lean cows, then another dream of 7 healthy heads of grain followed by 7 sickly ones. Joseph interpreted these dreams for the Pharaoh. According to the New International Version of the Bible, this was God's way of revealing that Egypt faced 7 years of good harvest to be followed by 7 years of drought and famine. The Pharaoh therefore ordered that a portion of harvest for the following good years be put aside for reserve against the coming lean years. His wisdom saved his nation. This places Joseph as the first Keynesian economist. Keynes taught us that during good times, government should accumulate surpluses from taxes exceeding expenditures. This cools what we now call irrational exuberance in markets while stemming inflation. When, in the normal course of events, the business cycles downward, as they always will in a capitalist economy, government should spend the accumulated surpluses or borrow funds to stimulate the economy while cutting taxes. With the boost provided by lower taxes, public works projects, and social benefits, a downturn can be reversed and an equilibrium restored. It appears that the good Mr. Harper has paid heed to neither the biblical Joseph nor John Maynard Keynes as economists. Steve arrived in office to find the liberals left him a fat budget surplus in the multi-billions and a national economy that was booming. He could not wait to squander that surplus through tax cuts, subsidies, and gratuitous supports for the corporate sector. After more than 2 years of this, the Canadian federal government is barely holding a balance in the budget, and with the collapse of American finance spilling over to Canada's commodities and manufacturing, it looks like we will soon be in deficit just as we head into a recession. Canada is tapped out. Interest rates are already below the rate of inflation, and our cupboard is bare when it comes to means to combat business failures, defaulted debts, and unemployment. Thanks a lot, Steve. You've done a great job for your country. Either you or your successor will be left with a grab bag of damaged goods and no tools to ameliorate the disaster you have helped to create. A pox on you and your party. Power is a funny thing. It's hard to define in all its manifestations, but we usually recognize when it is applied or absent. We begin life absolutely powerless as infants, dependent on others for our every need and comfort. Gradually, we grow to take charge of our lives until our rebellious teens, when we become wiser than our parents and challenge their power over us. We finish school, leave the nest, and suddenly we are free. But then we're shocked to find there are others who have power over us with whom we must share power. We have employers and spouses, landlords and lenders, police and governments. We voluntarily relinquish a degree of personal power as part of the social contract. I discovered how totalist surrender could be when, just barely 18, I enlisted in the U.S. Army, exchanging freedom and power over my destiny for 3 squares, a place to sleep, and a chance to serve the time that would put my military obligation behind me. I found I had become chattel, effectively government property. I recall my introduction to basic training when a friendly drill instructor told us recruits, "Give your soul to the Lord, 'cause your ass belongs to me." Agents of government, in the form of charming sergeants and concerned officers, determined when I would eat those 3 squares, where I would bed down, and whether I was to be put in danger of imminent death or dismemberment. Fleeting illusions of power made my powerlessness more evident. The training guaranteed when I enlisted became unavailable. When I completed alternate training, I was asked where I would like to be stationed in the wide world of U.S. military occupation. I selected Greenland or Germany, as I dislike hot weather. Within weeks, I was on a troop ship headed for Panama via Guantanamo, Cuba. Some people are driven by a lust for power. Stephen Harper is a prime example. His every action and statement from his days with a right-wing think tank through his smarmy photo opportunities with his newly discovered family, his freshly acquired sweaters, or his concern for the hands-on feeding of Chinese children has been in service of acquiring the absolute power of a majority prime minister. What do people do when they obtain absolute power? The results of acquired power can be frightening. A notorious psychology experiment divided student participants between fictitious guards and prisoners. The result was serious abuse by those appointed as guards, abuse serious enough that the experiment had to be curtailed. We know what happened when Stalin and Hitler were granted absolute power in their respective realms. Here, in supposedly civilized democratic societies, we see what even limited power can do. Look at the death and destruction caused by George Wanker Bush in less than 8 years, even with the constraints of his Supreme Court and Congress. Look at the way Stephen Harper has changed Canada in just over 2 years, even with a minority in Parliament and public opinion. Look at BC's provincial government under the Liberals. Their policy manual for the last election, entitled A New Era for British Columbia, made some interesting claims for what a Liberal regime would do. They promised open and accountable decision-making. Right. Now the normal fall sittings of our legislature has been arbitrarily canceled, leaving important decisions to be made behind a veil of cabinet secrecy. We watched a precious public resource, our railway, given away in direct violation of a pledge to keep it. Oh yes, they didn't really lie. They did not sell it. They just leased it for 999 years, after which it will be returned to us, and then negotiated this deal in secret. My point is that once we hand power over to our fate of others, they often act like they have a God-given right to tread over our wishes and rights. We shall see whether today's election gives the Harper regime that unique absolute power conferred by a majority party upon a majority party in Canada. If he acquires this power, the mask will come off, and we will see what his handlers and supporters have planned for the fate of Canada. I tremble. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. It was not long ago that leaders of the Coalition of the Killing occupying Afghanistan were united in declaring, "We don't negotiate with terrorists." Something has changed in the last weeks. Either we will negotiate with terrorists, or the Taliban has ceased to be classified as a terrorist organization. The United Nations Special Envoy in Afghanistan, Kai Eide, told a news conference that the war's solution will require more political energy. This is code for talking with the enemy. Do you suppose that this change of mind might have something to do with the statements by Britain's military commander in that occupied country? He said that a military victory is impossible, and that success, whatever that may mean, can only be accomplished through political means, including dialogue between all relevant parties. The puppet Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has been vocal in advocating negotiations with the Taliban. Is his leash slipping, or is this the feeling of his foreign handlers? Both Obama and McCain declare there will be no surrender during their watch. We shall see. We have a new addition to the list of domestic enemies of Canada. Move over Muslim extremists and illegal combatants. This group of terrorist sympathizers intends to undermine essential elements of our national security by subterfuge under the guise of a religion. I refer, of course, to that noted hotbed of radicalism, the Hutterites. The Hutterite religion traces its roots back to the 16th century Reformation. Its member colonies, now almost entirely in prairie states and provinces, with an odd splintered in Japan, have been shifted from pillar to post over the centuries due to persecution. A basic tenet of Hutterites is absolute pacifism. They may not take part in military activities nor wear uniforms of any sort. They don't take outside orders or contribute to war taxes. Their beliefs, as well as their communal lifestyle, where most property is owned by the local group, has led to oppression and even ejection by governments. During World War I, Hutterites in the United States suffered persecution for their pacifism and use of German. Remember, this is a time when Frankfurters became hot dogs and sauerkraut was called victory cabbage. Some Hutterites were jailed and two died of mistreatment in Leavenworth Prison. 17 Dakota colonies then moved north to Canada. Hutterite society is democratic within colonies to an extent that we might envy. Through an elaborate system of voting, most decisions are arrived at with majority approval. Their colonies are generally well-run, efficient, and prosperous. Although most are engaged in farming with modern equipment, they're increasingly into manufacturing. Hutterite colonies attempt to remove themselves from the outside world as much as possible. Purists refuse to allow televisions, radios, and recorded music. Some colonies are relenting, allowing telephones and radios and even limited internet, but for business purposes mainly. Hutterites are insulated from advertising, meaning that they will not flock gaily to their neighborhood mallwart to buy the shiny junk advertised therein. They will not send their children to fight in foreign wars. They do not attempt to keep up with the Joneses, buying oversized houses and filling them with rubbish bought on the Never Never. In a word, their style is inimical to the Canadian way of life, and they are, by definition, subversives. For some time, Hutterites in Alberta were granted an exemption from the rule that driver's licenses must have a photograph. To this sect, photos are considered graven images in violation of the Second Commandment. This exemption is being challenged by our federal government on the grounds that photoless licenses should not be valid for identification, as they thwart computerized facial recognition programs designed to spot imposters intent upon mayhem. A government brief to our Supreme Court declared the consequences could be grave of an Alberta exemption, enabling terrorists to clone the identity of Hutterites to do their evil deeds and place our entire nation in serious danger. In these days when terrorists lurk under every bed, we must not allow this avenue for them to flock on board our airplanes, disguised as Hutterites, crashing them into skyscrapers. We must not allow them into our buses, beheading innocent tourists. We must not allow them into our schools, slaughtering little children with automatic weapons. I mean the terrorists' automatic weapons, not the armed kids. Join your friends and neighbors demanding that our government clamp down on these enemies within, these Hutterites who can sow the seeds of mayhem and social destruction upon us. Okay, come on, Canada, get a grip. Admit that the war on terror has become ridiculous. Did you ever wonder how the average citizen felt and reacted during the collapse of empires? Did Romans know their empire, spanning the known world, was being overrun by barbarians? Did the Dutch realize that implosion of the frenzy now known as Tulip Mania would usher in the end of their rule in the world? Did the British foresee that victory in World War II foreshadowed the end of the pound as the world's reserve currency and dissolution of that invincible empire upon which the sun never set? Did Americans and most of the rest of the world foresee that a drop in the value of common stocks in October 1929 would ripple through the planet's economy, bringing on a decade of depression and another world war? How did the average citizens react to the foregoing events, supposedly divorced from their quotidian concerns? Like the apocryphal boiled frog, not realizing that it was slowly cooking, I suspect that people were slow to react to events considered to be remote from their lives. They continued to shop, go to work or school, make plans for the future based on their experiences with a stable past. As all people and civilizations do in times of relative tranquility, they ran their economic and political systems, their very lives, by looking in the rearview mirror, assuming the future would mimic the past. Comparisons are being made between today's stock market turmoil and the credit chaos and the fabled crash in 1929. The mess now embroiling the world has some frightening parallels with the Great Depression, but many differences. We tend to think of that former collapse as happening in a moment of time when stocks dropped by 90%, industry ground to a halt, and suddenly millions were riding the rails looking for work or a handout to survive. But the New York stock market did not hit bottom until 1933. For 4 years, it fell and rose, always dropping to a new bottom. Industry did not grind to a halt all at once. Contagion spread gradually over the years. People caught up in this decline could not foresee how this simple drop in stocks, then owned and traded by a slim minority, would affect all. So here we are in the 21st century, most of us thinking that today's fall in stocks, commodity prices, and the Canadian dollar don't matter to us. We have our homes, jobs, and student places. Our dollars continue to work. We can still shop with our credit cards. We throw the switch and the lights goes on. First furnaces keep us warm. Gasoline still flows into our cars at the corner station. What's the worry? Well, all assumptions of stability are on the table. Debt was one of the precipitating factors behind the 1929 debacle, yet the level of indebtedness in the roaring 20s was minuscule compared with the balloon of owing we've seen in the financial deregulation begun by Reagan and Thatcher. This was inspired by the fabled economic guru Milton Friedman. Allowing financial industries a free rein promised to bring permanent prosperity to all. Such a web of indebtedness has grown that no one understands the total picture of false values, all predicated on a slender base of real assets and expectations. As this creation of interconnected borrowing grew more complex and opaque, we all became invested in the false prosperity and confidence it has spawned. Governments, especially Bush's American, believed they could expand their indebtedness without limit. Homeowning individuals, reassured by rising resale prices, used home equity as a base for borrowing to support a rising spending even as wages stagnated. We stand and watch the unwinding of inflated stocks, home equity, and illiquid debt as spectators, but we're all going to be participants in this one. Governments are taking unprecedented steps as they try to stop the contagion, but these are seen as indications of panic, driving individuals to panic themselves. In the last week, I've become familiar with a term I had not heard in economics classes. It is capitulation. The point of capitulation in a market is that time when masses of investors and speculators are driven to capitulate, to panic, and order the dumping of all stocks at the market and to hell with the price. Everyone's rushing to the exits, and if buyers are not there to soak up the masses of equity for sale, there's no bottom to prices, no matter what the inherent value of the companies whose ownership these stocks represent. Some governments are trying to stem this mass exodus by acting as backstop players, buyers of equity, but they're trying to solve one problem on the back of another. Those governments must finance the purchases with debt or by just printing more money. They made the implicit assumption that a huge bout of inflation is preferable to economic turmoil, but so far it looks like they will get both. If they print money without backing, we get hyperinflation, the most extreme of which can be seen in the stories of wheelbarrows of money toted in for a loaf of bread in Germany between the wars. Or in Zimbabwe now, where the government caused inflation to such an extent that they're printing billion-dollar bills. If governments sell bonds to finance the purchases, they'll be soaking up investors' dollars that won't be available for investments in private assets. This attempt to stem a loss of spending becomes just another cause of contraction. Whatever comes of this current turmoil, we will pay for the excesses that precipitated it. History is being made today. Buckle up. One characteristic of a functioning democracy is a police force under control of elected officials. Cops are not above the law. They do not make policy, they follow orders. Parliament constructed our criminal code, and police exist to enforce the laws as written and interpreted by the courts of the land. Taking this as a given, what are we to make of the RCMP's commissioning academic research? Our federal police force spends about $1 million a year on reports from academics. Perhaps they could rationalize these studies in some way if they were not ordering reports to support their biases. The Pivot Legal Society of Vancouver exposed the fact that the RCMP paid for studies designed to discredit the benefits of safe injection sites. The cops in Vancouver dislike InSight and want to deter the establishment of similar sites in other communities, including Prince George. We've had enough scandals involving our federal police. It's past time for the federal government, no matter what its stripe, to make it clear that police are not rogues, but servants of the public through our elected representatives. This has been the 287th edition of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM at the University of Northern British Columbia in Prince George, rebroadcast on CHLS in Lillooet and CJLY in Nelson Kootenay Lake. I won't be here next week, so my next presentation will be in a fortnight. Adios, pilgrims.